I'm grateful for the very gracious introduction, and I'll try to live up to it. I have prepared an address, or I had prepared an address. It's going to be a little bit modified because I attended the session last night, and it seemed to me that a slight deviation from the outline that I gave might be useful, especially since the sentence was read to you. There is no covenant recorded in Scripture with a woman. And talk a bit about women in Judaism. There'll be a particular reason for that, as you see. Now, the first thing to talk about is just what the word covenant and what a covenant was, and then beyond that, what did a covenant mean? The Hebrew word for covenant is pronounced by German-speaking Jews as bris, by Israelis as brit, and you find it in English as brit, B-R-I-T-H, and B'nai Brith, the organization, simply means sons of the covenant. A few years ago, Professor Mendenhall at the University of Michigan, in the quest for the background of the term and the idea, made the suggestion that the form of covenant recorded in Scripture goes back to peace treaties made between a conquering power and a subjected power. Now, that may well be the case, but one is allowed to have reservations even about theories of responsible scholars. And it's just as easy to suppose that the Hebrew experience of relationships between men and the natural development of a contract could as readily explain the form of covenant as could a theory of a peace treaty. A covenant is a contract between two contracting parties. And in the contract, the covenantal terms, each side agrees to do particular things. Failure to live up to the covenant would imply that the covenant is broken and annulled, and that the party which has not offended is released from the contractual terms that have been stipulated. Now, that in general is what a contract or a covenant means. Much more significant for our purposes is the context in Scripture in which the covenant is described, the context in which covenants are made. We find these made both with individuals and also made with collective communities. The earliest mention of a covenant, significantly, comes at the conclusion of the story of Noah and the flood. Now, I ought to register this little protest about the reading of that part of Genesis, that there are many people who think that Noah is the hero of the account, and this is, in my opinion, is not true. It is the deity who is the hero of the account. For the story begins in Genesis 6 with the account of how mankind became corrupted when the sons of the gods came to earth and saw that women were rather beautiful. We are not told there just in what way they trespassed or what they did was wrong. The inference would be that on seeing beautiful human women, they were led to unseemly lust. At any rate, Scripture ascribes to these unions the beginning of that corruption in mankind, which increases to the point that the deity is depicted as repenting his having created man. Thereupon he sends the flood that's going to destroy everybody except one family, and that the family of Noah. Now, after this destruction takes place, the deity again has a change of heart. He recognizes the waywardness of man, but never again will he bring total destruction. And that is the essence of the covenant, the symbol of which is the rainbow. In context, this first covenant is an assertion of the deity's recognition of the nature of man and recognizing that the heart of man is prone to evil, at least from adolescence onward. I'm not so sure that we would defer it that long. But what does one do if one makes a decision he will not destroy the trespasser. The decision is to rehabilitate him. And this rehabilitation is designed to come about through a chosen people who arise in the context in which there are many, many nations. The story of the Tower of Babel answers several questions. Why is it that people speak different languages? There the answer comes in a wonderful pun that can't be transferred into English. At Babel, God babbled the language of people. The people scattered over the face of the earth, and when this disunity among men, division among men, had taken place, that's when Abraham comes onto the scene. From the standpoint of the biblical author, the Hebrew people have the history of having been originally a succession of three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in the case of Abraham and Isaac, each begot more than one child, but only one child was in the elect line of descent. The other child or children were tangential. In the case of Jacob, he had 12 sons who became the progenitors of the 12 tribes, and when the tribes had increased, then they became the nation, the people of Israel. We ought not to stumble over terminology, whether we say the people of Israel or the nation of Israel, for if we'll just remember that the ancient Hebrews had no idea about 19th century European nationalism, and not attribute to the word nation in this context the ebb and flow of nationalisms in Europe a century ago, it's safe to use the term. The point is that there was a corporate body, no longer individuals, but a tremendous body of people. Parenthetically, those of you who are students of Scripture will know that Professor Martin Note makes a strong assertion that the notion of a collective Israel, as found in Scripture, is historically inaccurate, that collective Israel did not arise until after the settlement in Palestine and the rise of monarchy. And I mention this only so that you'll know that I know about Professor Note, and having said that and granting the possibility that he's right and saying it's much more important to stick to the scriptural account. For it is how the Bible understands itself that is significant to us, and these details that some of us in our pedantic moments must pursue are not nearly as significant. If you begin with a series of three patriarchs, then you have a covenant described in detail with Abraham in Genesis 15. That's the covenant with the individual. When you get to the collective covenant, it is described in two places. One in Exodus chapter 19, where it begins, and then in chapter 24 when it concludes. There is still another version of this collective covenant in Deuteronomy chapter 29. Later on, we'll read of the renewal of the covenant with Joshua, and a rather strong emphasis in the time of David is still another renewal of the covenant. That is to say, the covenant was, I'll read you some of the words from Deuteronomy, the covenant was designed to be perpetual and to involve just more, much more than that one individual or that collective group assembled at the time of the completion of the covenant. I'm going to read you Deuteronomy 29. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he had made with them in Horeb. Horeb, you know, is Sinai. And Moses called unto all Israel and said to them, You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes. Now I'm going to, for economy of time, to skip a few verses. Down to verse 10. You stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders, and your officers, with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your women, and the stranger that is in your camp, from the hewer of wood and to the drawer of water, that you should enter into covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath which the Lord your God makes with you this day, that he may establish you today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto you a God, as he has said unto you, and as he has sworn unto your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that stands here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day. It's a covenant incumbent on the children too, on future generations. In Exodus 19 and 24, the covenant sandwiches in the Ten Commandments and the ascent of Moses to the top of Sinai. There we read that the deity is going to enter into a covenant, and in Exodus 24, the book of the covenant is read to the people, and it is there upon ratified in blood. The sprinkling of blood ratifies the covenant. It is rather difficult to know precisely in the intervening chapters, 20 through 23, what the terms of the covenant are. One opinion, which I believe is correct, is that the Ten Commandments represent the terms of the covenant. But if this is the case, then we see that immediately the Ten Commandments, laconic as they are, come to be expanded by additional legal material appearing right after the Ten Commandments in that context. What this all amounts to is that it's well and good to say there's a covenant between the deity and men, but then you've got to ask, what is it that men are supposed to do? What is the obligation that's undertaken? And we can summarize this by saying, on the one level, the obligation is to be loyal to the deity. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And then there are those ethical requirements of a social nature which implement or specify what loyalty means. By specifying what loyalty means, by specifying what the ethical requirements are, man is not left uncertain as to what it is that's expected of him. It was the Hebrew manner to make these things specific, to make these things specific in terms of an elaborate system of laws that begin in Exodus 20, encompass much of the rest of Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. In fact, once the Hebrews are brought in the account to Sinai, narration pretty much disappears and legislation takes its place. And in fact, if one is interested, let's say, in just following the narration in the Pentateuch, he could readily enough move from Exodus 20 to the second account of Moses' ascent to the sacred mountain in Exodus 33 and 34. From there, jump to Numbers 11, linger in Numbers for about three chapters, and then move to about Numbers 22 for a chapter or two, and then move to the last chapter of Deuteronomy. By implication, all the rest is a description of the origin and specification of the legal requirements. the symbol of the covenant was a set of two stones on which there were inscribed the Decalogue. And these two stones were kept in the sacred ark, which in the wilderness period, as envisaged in Scripture, was a portable ark in a portable sanctuary, ultimately to give way to the temple which Solomon built in Jerusalem. The Ten Commandments were a specification of the contract. They were also a symbol of the contract. The deity promised protection. The deity demanded loyalty and obedience. In what context? If man is what he is and the deity is not going to destroy mankind again, then how is man going to be rehabilitated? And the answer is by a covenant people which will meet the deity's demands and standards and be a witness to the peoples. This is a term to be found in Isaiah. Witnesses to the people of the deity's wishes and intentions and demands. It is very hard to read the pre-exilic prophets because in many cases the text has come down to us in the Hebrew through difficulties in transmission. If one intends to read the prophets, then a good prologue to reading them is to understand that they take the covenant for granted. They speak against the background of a covenant, and it is their contention. What prompts them to speak is their conviction that Israel has broken the covenant. If Israel has broken the covenant, then the covenant is ruptured, and the deity, the one of the contracting parties, is now freed from the obligations he assumed at the time the covenant was made. In the terms of an Amos, now that the covenant is ruptured, a foreign foe can invade. In terms of Isaiah, not only does the foreign foe invade, but in Isaiah 10, the deity brings the foreigners to punish Israel. And there is that majestic passage in the 10th chapter of Isaiah that heaps scorn on the Assyrian conqueror who thinks that he's done this by the power of his own might. And the prophet taunts him, does the saw boast over him who wields it? Does the axe vaunt itself over him who chops with it? If the covenant is broken, Israel is without protection, and there are consequences. Scripture isn't precise about this, but the ancient rabbis make this assertion, that the terms of the covenant represented the minimal demand. For the Hebrews to be a kingdom of priests and a holy people involved at least a minimal demand. The covenant didn't exhaust all that a person could conceivably do. It meant that a person could never do any less than this. And the ancient rabbis like to give the example of Abraham in Genesis 18, who welcomed three visitors, ran out to greet them, invited them to sit under the tree and rest themselves, wash themselves. He ran to the flock and chose an animal to be served to them. He went to Sarah and told her to take fine meal and bake bread. Did he observe the laws of hospitality, or did he go beyond the laws of hospitality? There is an expression which the ancient rabbis use, beyond the letter of the law. The covenant is the minimum. And what is the motive in covenant? Can it be fear? Yes. But is there a higher motive? Love of God? The book of Deuteronomy stresses it. For immediately after the hero Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. The motive is specified. And Micah asks the question, in the light of an abundance of regulations about animal sacrifices, is it animal sacrifices that the deity wants? If that were the case, it's easy to bring them in abundance. But he has told you, O man, what the Lord requires of you. You know the passage as well as I do. To love mercy, to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Hey, Jeremiah introduces something brand new. For there is a legacy of laws, and there is also the problem of the basic attitude. And there is a tradition of the symbol, the Ten Commandments written on stone. And when Jeremiah speaks of a new covenant, it will not be written on stone as was the old covenant, but written in the hearts of people. There was then this constant quest for understanding the relationship between the deity and Israel, between the deity and the people of his covenant, and understanding that deepened with the passing of time, and deepened in several ways. First, a strong assertion that what was in the heart was as important as the regulations themselves. And next, an inquiry into the motivation. Why should one do these things? Should it be from fear, or should it be from the press of wonderful and great opportunity? Now the covenant. Much as we can admire its situation, and the way in which it's formulated, is only a form of expressing the relationship between the individual and the deity, or between other people and the deity. A wonderful form, but only a form. That we have the individual covenants with Abraham twice, once in Genesis 15, another time in Genesis 17, in which circumcision seals the covenant, meant that there was an inevitable sense among the Hebrews of the distinction between the individual in the covenant community and the covenant community as a totality. This has always been a problem in sacred societies, for there is a variation among individuals, and in a collective community, one can discover, realistically, the righteous and the unrighteous. One can ask the question, what is the force of an individual? The biblical account of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah gives us a wonderful answer. We might comment that the allusions to Sodom and Gomorrah throughout the prophets are frequent, and not one of them mentions Abraham in connection with this destruction. The account in Genesis brings them into connection, and brings them into connection in which Abraham is depicted as though he's discussing with a fellow human being, for the Hebrew writers had no reluctance about depicting God as though he were intelligible to men. So Abraham talks to God in a way not much different from the way in which Abraham barters with Ephron the Hittite for the cave in which to bury Sarah, wherein Ephron says to him, well, the cave is yours, the field goes along with it, you can have it. And Abraham wants to know the price, and Ephron says, well, what's the difference? It's only 400 pieces of money, what's that between you and me? So Abraham knows what the price is. In Genesis 18, the issue is raised first. Can Abraham intercede on behalf of the wicked people of Sodom? And this wonderful, wonderful scene in which Abraham bargains and gets the deity to reduce the terms from 50 righteous men in Sodom down to 10 in Sodom. And having achieved this, even that is insufficient to save Sodom. But you have in this passage the suggestion that in an age of wickedness, a minimum of righteous people can bring about safety and rescue. You see what I mean? That the Scripture keeps talking about the implications. For covenant is a form, and the implications become just as important as the form itself. The ancient rabbis included those who tabulated how many laws there were in Scripture. This is always difficult to do because in the way in which Scripture is written, you don't know where one law stops and another begins, so the two people can come up with different counts, even with a computer. They came up with the number 613. And they divided them into two categories. 365 of them are prohibitions, things you must not do. And 248 of them are affirmations, things you must do. You must fast on such and such a day. You must bring a tithe. You must bring an offering. The difference between a prohibition and an affirmative injunction, I'm sure, is clear. Now, the ancient rabbis made this assertion that women have to observe the negative commandments, but they're exempt from observing the affirmative commandments. Why? Because Scripture, the rabbinic literature, and the literature of the New Testament are written from a totally masculine viewpoint, a masculine-dominated society, a society in which legally women were subservient. We need not be surprised that there is no record in Old Testament of a covenant between the deity and a woman. I don't think that admirable as is the imagination of biblical writers, and the Hebrew writers were as gifted with the pen as any people have ever been, it would never have occurred to them in their setting and in their civilization to have depicted a woman as directly a recipient of a covenant. It isn't that they would necessarily have opposed it. It just wouldn't have occurred. That they mention Deborah as a judge and Deborah as a prophetess, and in 2 Kings 22, in the days of Josiah, when in the refurbishing of a temple in Jerusalem, they come across a scroll of the law, and King Josiah is puzzled with what to do. He turns for counsel to a prophetess, Huldah. Now, I think that for two women to emerge as they do in that masculine civilization is an unusual conception. There is a passage towards the end of Deuteronomy in which the daughters of Zelophehad come to Moses and ask the question, where do they stand with respect to the laws of inheritance? Can women inherit? Now, as we read this section, we discover that Moses gives the affirmative answer. And the affirmative answer must have come out of a context in which antecedently the answer was negative. So one can infer, one can't state positively, but one can infer that there's been a change in the state of affairs, in my judgment, a change for the better. But I don't think we need have reluctance to say that the writers of Old Testament and Roman Catholics and Anglicans will allow me to use the phrase Apocrypha for purpose of communication without raising the question of what is canon. In the Apocrypha and in the New Testament, though there are women who rise to certain eminence, they are all individuals. In the Apocrypha, the story of Susanna is told only to tell us how wise Daniel was. And the way in which there are additions in the Apocrypha to the book of Esther is of some significance. In the Hebrew text of Esther, God goes unmentioned. And some of the ancient rabbis didn't think that Esther belonged in Scripture. I could have given better reasons, because the ending of the book of Esther distresses me. The Greek translators make good the omission by adding to the book of Esther those prayers which a woman in Esther's situation as a loyal Jewess should have prayed. The story of Judith is dramatic, but it is not. I admire the literary skill, but it is not one of my favorite stories of a woman heroine, any more than is the act of Jael in Judges 4 and 5, who drove a tent peg into the head of the general Sisera. I'm not sure that that's the kind of woman I would like to be married to, but the text speaks of her, blessed is all above all women, is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. On the other hand, I don't know where one will find something more moving or more edifying than the story of Ruth. Now what? The recognition that I think we ought to make is that this was a masculine civilization, and the laws rested on those premises which were agreeable to males. Now, one particular item. In Deuteronomy, provision is made for divorce. A man can give his wife, he can divorce his wife by giving her a writ of divorcement. Nothing is said about a woman divorcing her husband. And in traditional Jewish law, amplified by the rabbis, as practiced by traditional Jews down to our time, divorce is frowned on. The stones of the altar of the temple in Jerusalem weep every time there's a divorce. And the social controls in Judaism opposed divorce, but divorce was legally permitted. The man could divorce the woman. The woman couldn't divorce the man. I would ask you to consider a distinction that I think is valid between what law prescribes and what society does. Sometimes law lags behind society. Sometimes law is in advance of society. I would say, for example, in our time, law is advanced, is in advance of society with respect to blacks. Those blacks with whom I'm in touch make this statement, I don't know that everybody will agree with it, that well, we don't need any more laws. What we need now is the implementation of the laws that we have. So the society can lag behind the laws, or the laws can be vestiges of a past age and society be more advanced than the laws. I would say that the legal position of women in Judaism doesn't depict the reality about the position of women. I would confess that We Jews have always had an emphasis on a male society. I suppose most of you have heard of bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is a ceremony that takes place when a boy is 13, when presumably he's physically mature and hopefully intellectually mature and ready to be regarded as an adult. You ask why 13? Because Jews originated in the Near East, and at the age of 13, puberty took place. I think in the West, 16 would be a better age. And please don't confuse the narrative in Luke of Jesus left at the temple by his parents at the age of 12 as bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah arose a thousand years after the time of Jesus. Where do women fit into bar mitzvah? Well, until about 25 years ago, they didn't. Bar mitzvah was exclusively for men, for boys. How about Jewish education in the ghetto before Jews were allowed to go to public schools? My parents. My father had an education, my mother didn't. At home, she learned to read and write. He learned it at school. In her own way, though she was a modest woman, she was rather proud of having acquired literacy, because it wasn't demanded of women, wasn't expected of women. With respect to this distinction between affirmative laws and prohibitions, I ought to add this dimension, that in the Jewish tradition, the synagogue is a supplement to the home. And one can be a Jew in good standing without ever entering a synagogue. And this is a matter of fact, and I hesitated to say it to fellow Jews because they think there's a sanction in these words for staying away from the synagogue. But as it works out practically, when, let's say, the Sabbath Eve and worship arrived, my father went to the synagogue and my mother stayed home to prepare dinner for him. Same with the high holidays. In the traditional synagogue, for public prayer, you need a minimum quorum, 10 people. That is 10 males. And women don't count. Where do women sit in the synagogue? In the traditional synagogue, they sit up in a balcony, separated from men. Now, there is a nice little homily that explains it, so that a man won't have his attention diverted from prayer to the women. But I think you can see that that's a rationalization. In some synagogues today where new architecture enters in, women will sit curtained off from men. One of the differences between Reformed Judaism and Orthodoxy was to break down the separation of men and women in worship. Now, having told you of the second-class citizenship that women had in Judaism until very recent times, then I would go on to say that that isn't the picture. Because the woman was the priestess of the home, and she was responsible for the rearing of the children and for their induction into the tradition, and inculcating into them the eternal verities, the standards and the attitudes. Recently, some American Jewish authors, one of whom has more skill than taste, wrote a book, Portnoy's Complaint. I did get through about 40-odd pages of it, in which the Jewish mother is sort of burlesque. Now, why do you have a burlesque of a Jewish mother? Because among us, all the rights lay with the father, but all the power lay with the mother. Not the legal, but the de facto. For the covenant was not exclusively with men. That's why I read you this passage. Men, women, and children. And women are as much involved in the covenant as men. when we read in the Gospels about Jesus and the 12, I hesitate to use the word disciple or apostle because there's a certain confusion in the terms, wherein Luke seems to conceive of the disciples as very, very numerous and the apostles as 12 elected among the numerous disciples, and Mark and Matthew do it somewhat differently. Among the 12, all are men. But especially in the Gospel according to Luke, there is an emphasis of interest in women. And the scholars point out that in the birth narrative in Matthew, the interest is in Joseph, but in the birth narrative in Luke, the interest is in Mary. And throughout the Gospel, according to Luke, there is a greater interest in women than in the other Gospels. When in 1 Corinthians we get the injunction that women should keep quiet in church, I think that sometimes women today are offended by that. I think if one knows that Paul came from a male environment, that he wasn't saying anything that he thought was startling. This was normalcy. And why it is that he said women should have their heads covered because of angels, whether that means angels or demons, we don't know. The German scholars debate over that. There isn't, as I see things, an effort to exclude. It's just that they developed a way of doing things, and women were put in a subordinate status. And within that subordinate status, they achieved a major status. Now, here I would like, as inoffensively as I can, to introduce a heresy to you. And it is this. Let us look to Scripture for spiritual guidance, but let us not assume that the writers of Scripture envisage every single situation that we will encounter today. And let us not assume that we can automatically apply one passage or two passages, or even in intellectual honesty, a distillation of 8 contradictions to some situation today and come up with the answer. In the modern Jewish synagogue, it ought to be no secret that women are the mainstay of worship. Women are the mainstay of the synagogue. And things have changed sufficiently that the direction of a synagogue, we organize synagogue, we have congregational autonomy, for which the synonym is chaos. But every synagogue has a board of trust or a board of trustees or a board of directors. And in the modern synagogue, a woman is just as eligible as a man. And for a woman to be the presiding head of the board of trustees of the synagogue is not too unusual. Nobody notices it when it happens. And in the organized form of Reform Judaism, the sessions that are taking place now in Los Angeles, women are delegates from their congregations as much as men and have the same authority to vote. Now, if you ask me realistically, have we gotten to the stage, let's say, in which an individual woman can command the same undiluted attention that a man does, then I would be gilding the lily if I said that were so. But I wonder if the difference isn't in the individual gifts that have been distributed among human beings. Legally, from this standpoint, there is no distinction. And if your Jewish friends have probably introduced you to enough bar mitzvah for girls, to know that this is no longer exclusively a boys' thing. And a number of you have asked me, I haven't been here very long, about the woman that he in our school, Sally Price, and who will be ordained a rabbi in June. If she continues to do the good work she's doing. She still had this year. Now, I would comment that ordination among Jews is different from ordination among Christians. And one of the difficulties that Jews and Christians have in talking with each other is they use a common vocabulary and the words mean different things. So if I tell you that Sally will be graduated this June, that may, and will be named rabbi, that may be clear. Now, at the time she applied for admission, I was the provost of our institution. Now, some of you don't know what a provost is. It is a term taken from church organization, especially in Britain, and a provost was usually the head of the cathedral. In American education, the president's responsible for raising money, and the provost is responsible for the education that goes on in the school. University of Massachusetts, there was a man appointed provost, and he was asked to define his job, and he said, it's the task of the president to make speeches and the task of students to think. Now, he sees to it that the students don't make speeches and the president doesn't think. Whereupon the president replied that from his standpoint, the president was the shepherd and the provost was the shepherd's crook. Now, it was when I was provost and admissions were my responsibility, the three young ladies were admitted. Two of them married and didn't stick with it. Sally has stuck with it. Now, she will be graduated. She is now serving part-time while she's in school, a congregation in Cincinnati. We live in Cincinnati. What is called in the electronics industry, the feedback. Feedback is very, very favorable. She's admired. She should be. Now, this is something new. What will eventually happen to her, no one can predict. Now, if you ask, did I have any problem when I gave consent for her admission and the admission of the others, there was no problem. Our school has always been open to anybody. And there is this sort of distortion about this young lady. She isn't the first. She's the first to get this far. We've had women who have entered with the intention for at least 30 years. It's just these other women haven't stuck by the intention. So that I hadn't any decision to make. I only had to say, are her academic and other credentials in good order? Now, this is a departure, and I think Jews like it, and Jews are amused by it, and Jews are edified by it. I don't know how deeply significant it is. I can't measure it. I suppose it's significant, but I can't measure the significance. But back to our context. The emergence of women to positions of responsibility seems relatively new, and now a movement that I am not greatly acquainted with. I read newspapers and magazines. Women's Lib has emerged on the scene. From my own perspective, this I remember. Jews didn't have the rights of citizenship in European countries until dates such as 1789 in France, in 1854 in Great Britain, and Catholics didn't have rights of citizenship in Great Britain until about 1832. And slavery endured in this country until 1863. And child labor was a blight all over the world in women's suffrage, the right to vote in this country, has come within the lifetime of people here in this room. We can be in despair as to how much more progress is needed, or we can look at the past and say, look how much progress has been made. I don't know which is the right attitude, but this I am certain of, that one can't speak of a covenant people and assume that a covenant people is a collection of males. A covenant people is a total people. And we ought not to move from the way in which at particular times law codes, whether the Hebrew Bible or the Jewish rabbinic law, or to trespass in an area where I'm rather ignorant, canon law or the discipline of the Methodist Church, when these things have been formulated in the past, they have been formulated by men of good will and good insight in the light of their own presuppositions, but formulated by men. And I think sometimes they didn't challenge their own presuppositions. If I were to ask this, having outlined for you the negative in the status of women, do I believe that women had a minor role? I would say that it wasn't men who preserved Judaism, it was women who preserved Judaism. And I mean that literally. And I think I'm in position to know because I came from a home that had a father and a mother. My father was a great scholar. Almost never at home. Out earning a livelihood or out discussing scholarship with his cronies. Who kept the home fires burning? And who taught us and who inducted us? The Friday evening service, among Jews who observe the Friday evening service, we have the same problems that Christians have, sometimes more acute, sometimes less acute, includes the reading at the dinner table prior to the meal, along with the bread and the wine of Proverbs 31. This is read at the dinner table. Whoso finds a virtuous woman, her value is far beyond rubies. The heart of her husband is safely trust in her. He has no need of spoil. She does good for him and not evil all the days of her life. She looketh well at the ways of her household. Her husband is known among the elders of the land when he sitteth among the children of the land. But strength and honor are her clothing. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and in her on her tongue is the law of kindness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. A woman of virtue, a woman of valor, we get different translations. I wonder if I could just teach you those two words. Eishes Chayil. Eishes Chayil. A woman of valor. Rather strange that the book of Proverbs, most of it devoted to telling young men how to stay out of trouble, especially with evil women, should end up with this poem to the Eishes Chayil. Now, I think that any thoughtful person has to recognize what the author of this remarkable poem had in mind, that in women there reside the potentials no less than those that reside in men, and that the self-realization takes place when men aren't obstacles to it, and that the legal force is not the story. The real story is, can human beings, men and women, make recognition of this potential of the Aceous Pile? Thank you.